listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our very special Sunday morning mailbag edition. I'm Scott Phillips. I've had a good sleep in. He is Andrew Page. He's just run three ultramarathons, and that's before breakfast. Mr. Page, how are you?
Tired. those ultramarathons really wear you out.
Oh, I suppose you've got three of them. One's okay, yeah. But by the time you do the third one, I suppose it probably gets a bit tough, does it?
You'll have to join me one of these mornings.
Oh, yeah.
I'll get you up at 2 a.m. and we'll do a few.
Of course. But you are from strawman.com, of course, which, as we know, is either a private or a premium online investment club, depending on who you ask. And even if you ask you, you give me different answers to the question.
Keeping
it fresh. I like that. Mate, I promise on – because I don't know why I do these things. I promise on Friday we'd talk about Bitcoin. And for reasons that are completely beyond me, I don't even know why I have to do this. But I do, so I will. mate, we had a good question from Scott. Now, Scott is the teacher at Catamatite Primary School, for those who've been following along with the kids from Catamatite. You also want to talk about Bitcoin because apparently it's been doing okay. I guess every bubble's got to have its, popping at some point, I guess. I don't know. I will ask Scott's question, then I will let you talk about Bitcoin, and then if the gods are kind to me, we won't have to do it for a while. Scott says, I like the way he says, introduce this how you like, but a legitimate question for Rambo on the pod machine. He's been saying for a while that a wise investor should have at least 1% of their portfolio in Bitcoin. Well, I do, says Scott. In brackets, well, mostly Bitcoin anyway. Sounds like there's some other cryptos there. But it's because of the recent rise. He says, I'm up 300% on the initial investment, which is when I add the hashtag humblebrag, and not because I tipped in 1%. Should I be employing more capital so I've at least put in 1% or just smile and hang on for the ride? Sorry to let him off the leash. Regards, Scott. Scott, you are not sorry at all, mate. If you were sorry, you wouldn't do it. As a school teacher, you of all people know that if you're sorry, you don't do these things. He does finish saying, P.S., the kids from Caddy are still all right. I have no doubt about that whatsoever, Scott. Thank you for the question. Well, no, actually, I don't mean that. Thank you for the message. I don't thank you for the question at all. Andrew, Bitcoin, Scott says, up 300% recently. I suppose you'd like to start there, would you?
I'd call it about a 200% gain from the recent bear market low.
Right, right.
Yeah, look, it's been. I was actually thinking the other day. It's been about a year exactly since we did a Bitcoin special episode.
Crazy! It felt like about 2 months ago. Isn't that funny? How time flies.
Yeah. No. It's a lifetime ago in Bitcoin.
Exactly. In Bitcoin years. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. It was a harder conversation to have because. Yeah, the price was down so much.
Yeah.
But I guess I thought, like, it's worth – and this is going to be super hard, but I promise everyone I'm going to keep it as short as I can. The only thing – I raised it with you is because it's back at all-time highs and it's starting to creep into the media and all the usual BS that comes with that is now on our doorstep. And it can cause a lot of problems and it always – is discussed in a very, I think, ill-informed kind of manner. So I thought, well, let's celebrate that it's gone up. Okay, that's nice. But I want to reframe it right from the beginning. I think this is something that's legitimately just new. And as investors, we try and put it through these templates and people say, oh, but it doesn't produce cash flow and it doesn't do this. And it's a new thing, right?
Yep.
And I think when you're looking at a company, you've just got to stand back, right? And you'll remember you and me doing this pod in 2017 and me just, you bought $100 worth and I thought you were crazy. Yeah, and I was like giving you so much rubbish for it.
I've sold them too, compounding the error.
Well, see, it crashed, right? Mm-hmm. And then it rallied up again and then it crashed. Mm-hmm. And then it rallied up again and it crashed. There's a great meme on that, by the way, too. It's like, don't buy Bitcoin, it's always crashing. Because it kind of always is.
Right.
But the thing is, when you look at tulips and other kinds of bubbles and stuff, they don't, Bernie Madoff doesn't come back for round two, Ponzi's once they're exposed are gone. So I think we're at a point now where it's kind of like, something's interesting going on. If you look at it at a log chart from the beginning of time, it smooths out a lot of that volatility.
Yeah,
and I think You know, people get hung up on the volatility. It's like, well, what was Amazon stock like when it was new? What was Apple stock like? They were all totally volatile. Right.
Yep.
And here you've got potentially, here you've got a new form of money organically spinning itself up, bootstrapping itself from zero in an entirely unorchestrated kind of way to a point where it's now being adopted by Wall Street. The ETFs are now in combined size. You know, they won't be long before they knock off gold in terms of the market cap value. It's something's going on, right?
Yeah.
And I guess before all the headlines start hitting the news, it's worth just sort of arming people for it, because there is nothing that's a better marketing message for crypto than price go up. You know, rocket emojis, and it is so intoxicating to all of us. And I won't lie to you. I'm a big fan of Bitcoin. I'm very happy that it's gone up, but I was never buying it because I wanted to take my Australian dollars, turn it into another currency so I could then turn it back to Australian dollars for more later. Like, it's not, you've really got to get outside of this thing. It's a savings technology. And you need to almost look at it in the same way as if you had some money and you had the option easily of just buying some US dollars or some Japanese yen or that kind of thing. And knowing that it's basically, the proposition here is essentially is that, like any network, it obeys what's called Metcalfe's law. The more people that use it, the more value it has, the more utility it has, the more people want it, which makes it more valuable. It's this lovely flywheel kind of effect. And if that's, I mean, who knows what will happen tomorrow, but after 15 years of flawlessly working and now being adopted by the upper echelons of the financial sector, you think, okay, there's something to it. But if this is something that's just like, oh, I'm going to trade crypto, then you're mad.
Yeah,
I mean, right. You might as well go to the casino, right? So, yes, let's celebrate the wins. And I would say, well, if the Bitcoiners are right, this is nothing, right? Like, it's $1.4 trillion. It just overtook silver in terms of market cap. So there's more. If you take every ounce of silver known to man that's been mined and you times it by the current silver price, it's less than Bitcoin. I was like, okay, something's going on here. I'll get to the question. What's the right allocation? My argument originally was framed on the point of, look, at this point, which is, you know, a year or so ago, all of those things are true. Yep. Something's happening. The risk reward scenario is if this continues to gain traction, this is something that potentially in 10, 15 years could be $1 million of Bitcoin. I know that sounds like a mind blow, but it kind of could. And it's almost a failure of its promise if it doesn't sort of get to those levels. Or it goes to, or I don't think we're past the point of it ever going to zero, but it remains a very niche thing worth, you know, $10,000 each or something like that. And because of that asymmetry and because of the point of, we've made the comparison before between early stage biotech companies. You know, we're going to cure cancer. Like, are you though? Because 99.9999% don't.
Yeah.
But this is the biotech company
that's, get there. Yeah, yeah.
This is the just torture the analogy. This is the biotech company that's now commercialized and is getting early traction. And you say, what are the, for want of a better term, the users on the network? They're growing exponentially. Mm-hmm. So your view has to be that trend will continue, and as more people opt into it, it becomes more valuable. And know that it's just going, like being an early investor in Amazon, it's going to be insanely volatile. Like, it is. It's not a bug, it's a feature. It's like, how could it be anything other than that as the world tries to wrap its head around a new form of money? Like, are you kidding me? That's not controlled by anyone. And just, you know, it's just sort of, it's a very, I found that the people, you're a good example here actually, mate. The people most resistant to it are the people that are more sophisticated with investing, because it is so out of the box.
Right.
And it really, you know what I mean? It just doesn't fit in any bucket that it almost deserves, in fact, it does deserve a category of its own. And so very rambly long kind of answer, but I hope that helps. The only things I want to sort of stress for people in terms of the allocation.
Yes.
That is going to entirely be a function of your conviction and understanding of what it is. What Peter Lynch, right? Know what you own and why you own it. If you're buying it because I think it'll go up next year, then you're not investing, you're gambling, and it's just, you know, you probably get wrecked along the way. Keep that in mind. I've got more than 1%, I'm happy to admit. But I've got a really high conviction of it.
Yeah.
But I feel as though this point, the, again, that asymmetry is sort of like, gosh, what's the worst case that's going to happen if it goes to zero from here? You've lost 1%. And at this point, it looks like there's some pretty decent chances it's worth significant, even if it just replaces gold or takes half of gold's value, right? Like it's sort of, it's 500,000 US a coin at that point, like at half of gold. So it feels as though the more conviction you can have in that, the more that you could allocate to it. And only, and this is a really key point, only with money that you don't need to use in the next 3 or 4 or 5 years. I would only put money away of this that I don't need this for 5 years.
Yeah.
And we say much the same thing about shares, because even though shares are an incredible investment, it's volatile and I love them. And I would never put all my money into the share market, even under the most safest, biggest, bluest of blue chip companies. Yeah. If I thought that I needed to pay for a deposit in 6 months or a year or even 2 years, frankly, I'd have concerns about same. That kind yep. of stuff. Yep. So I hope that I don't want to sort of say on a pod, oh, you should have 20% or whatever. I feel at this point, it's very reasonable for even a skeptic to have a little bit, and then the higher your conviction goes, I think the higher it can go. Just realize that you, like anyone who's held this thing for long term, they have gone through multiple 70% drawdowns. And if you don't like the idea of that, then I'm waiting for the messages to come from my mates, because everyone's happy to sort of poke fun at me when it's down.
Yeah, right.
Absolute silence, radio silence. At this point. And at some point it'll drop from like 150,000 Australian to like 120, and I'll get all the messages going, aha, I knew it, I knew it. It's like, right. No, it's what's going to happen. So do that. Yeah. Another thing that I want to stress very carefully is that hopefully we flushed a lot of this out of the system, but expect a lot of affinity scams, which are essentially altcoins.
Right.
There's another name for them as well. But
yes.
You know, this is another thing that's very, I won't lecture people on it now, but just point them in the right direction to do their own research. Bitcoin's a one-time invention. It's like the internet. It's like electricity. It's like steam power. It's like, okay, it's been invented now. You can tweak it and you can do all the kinds of things, but you can never replicate the genesis of it, the network effect of it, the hash power of it, the social acceptance. It's run away to a point. We've often used the VHS Betamax example.
Yeah,
it's it's 3 years in after that was decisively won. Betamax is gone. It's never coming back, right? And you will find in this cycle lots of people telling you about new blockchains that do this and do that and promise this. And it's a very dangerous thing, because they're all going to fail, in my very humble opinion. And I think that history has so far borne that out with all of these things. They've largely been a den of sin and scam and grift. And that will happen again, because the one of the problems people have is a unit bias. They go, what's Bitcoin? You look it up. Oh, 110,000 Australian dollars of Bitcoin. I can't afford that. Oh, here's Kitty coin. It's only 1 cent. I can afford that. Bitcoin is like a dollar. There are cents to it. You can buy a dollar's worth of Bitcoin. You can buy $10 worth of Bitcoin. Yep. You can buy any amount of Bitcoin that you want. So it is, I think it is that natural misunderstanding that will drive people to think they need to go elsewhere. And the other problem with it is people look at the chart and they go, oh, you know, in 2010, I could have bought it for $100 and now it's, you know, whatever. And I feel as though that's an anchoring bias that we often talk about with shares as well. It's just like, well, if it lives up to the potential, you're always going to be buying the top. That's kind of what is always going to happen. And be that the case with Amazon and other great success stories, that's actually been a pretty winning strategy. In fact, averaging up into something that's continuing to become more and more certain and more strong as an economic unit. But this is my attempt to do a short answer, and we must be like 20 minutes in, so I'll take a breath, mate, and shut up.
No, that's a good answer, mate. It's a very, very thoughtful answer, as always, mate, from you. So
there's so much to say about it. I worry is that you sort of say something and because it's so unfamiliar, people very naturally will take away things that aren't exactly your intent with this. Yeah, and it's very easy to come across as a cheerleader and, hey, it's up and look how clever I am, or you know, everyone should get on this thing. You're all going to be millionaires. And it's like, no, because there's a lot of that out there already. It's just an encouragement to sort of say, I think we're at a point now. It's just like, you don't have to do anything with it. In fact, you shouldn't do anything with it if you don't understand it. But if you're intellectually curious at all, I think it's worth scratching below the surface. And then as you build a knowledge, you'll find the allocation that's right for you. If it is anything above zero, although I think 1% is a very sensible allocation.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Here's Max.
That was 15 minutes too. I just looked at the timer.
And that was the short version. That was the short version.
I'm so sorry.
No, mate, no, not at all. Not at all. You are actually very restrained. Given your passion about this and how keen you are, I really appreciate your level-headed approach to sharing it with our listeners because, as you say, it's the sort of thing that's A, very complex, B, can get people get very carried away with it. But you've been very, very responsible, mate. I think you've done a fantastic job. Max, though, says, Dear Andrew, could you please give me your views on both Bitcoin and housing, including the pros and cons of each, and a detailed summary as to why I should invest in your preferred option? Haha, just joking.
Are you joking right now?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Oh, wow, I get another crack.
Although it wouldn't be made by any means if Rampage wanted to cut loose. I think you've been...
don't need to do anything.
Okay, all right. I did want to give you the option.
Don't go there. I mean, look, it's a competing store of value, right? There's always going to be pros and cons, and I'll leave it at that.
All right. He then says, Dear Scott and Andrew, could I please ask if it would be sensible to only invest at the time of a market crash? To complement this, you could also either save your money in a high-interest savings account or park it in the offset between opportunities. Thanks so much. I truly love everything you do. Thanks, Max. And that's from Max. It's a good question, mate, isn't it?
You go first, mate. I've hogged.
Wait for the question.
Yeah, I've hogged the mic.
So here's the thing, Max. It's a really, really, really good question. And if we had a system where things went from a stable level down every now and again back to that same stable level, you would be absolutely right. If shares went from 10 to 2 and then back to 10 every so often, and all you had to do was wait for the 2 and then buy and go to the 10 and then sell, that'd be perfect. So the question you ask is a great one. The challenge is that in the share market, as in most things in most assets, the prices will improve and increase over time. And so what you're doing is you're basically racing, whenever you don't participate in the market, you are betting that by the time you do, the crash will be big enough and fast enough and deep enough that you will make up not only the opportunity of the crash itself, but that shares wouldn't have gone up meaningfully in the time you've waited. So let me put some numbers behind that. And this is, I'm not saying this will happen at all, matter, but I'm trying to explain the scenario. Let's say you want to wait for a 25% crash. And so you're saying, well, look, when the shares go from 10 to 7.5, I will buy. That's the crash I'm looking for. I'm going to make a fortune. And I'll keep the money in cash. I'll get, I know, 4.5% in the meantime. That makes sense. But let's say the shares are currently only 4 and they go to 10 and then crash 25%. Well, you don't need me to tell you that between 4 and 7.5, even if you buy at that 25% discount, you've missed the opportunity to actually make more of your money on the way through. And that is really the only, that's the mental model. Now, if there's a crash tomorrow or in a week's time or in a year's time, you probably are better off having waited because the market may only go up 5 or 7 or 10% in the meantime. And if it falls 25% thereafter, you're still buying at 15% cheaper than the shares are today. But if the market goes up 25% before crashing by 20 or goes up 50% before crashing by 30, then you would have been much better off to have invested anyway and worn the loss, even though you're getting something with cash in the bank. Now, the higher interest rates are, the longer you can afford to kind of take this opportunity, if you like. So there's definitely something there. There's a there, if you like. I'll give you a really concrete example, mate. When the market crashed in the middle of COVID, the very, very, very lowest point, which frankly, you couldn't have known, you couldn't have picked in advance, the market was roughly there only 4 years earlier. Now, over that 4 years, you could have done very, very nicely if you'd known COVID was coming. The challenge is the time before that was back in 2010, time before that, and again, we go back and back further. And so this is the real challenge, mate, is the time it takes for the next crash. In fact, let's do that. We had the big crash in the GFC in 2009, then again, not until the COVID crash in 2020. Over that 11 years, the market went up massively. And so
it's a long time to be in cash.
Right, exactly. And so you waited and waited and waited and waited. Eventually, you got the opportunity to buy, at which time you could have actually had shares the whole time, collected dividends on top of that, by the way, the whole time. So you talk about cash in the bank. If you're investing in dividend paying shares, you can do exactly that and get the dividends plus the franking credits on the way through. It's a seductive idea, mate. If it was that possible, people would already be doing it, which is not a criticism and not to say you shouldn't have asked the question. Just, you know, Andrew and I have had the same thoughts from time to time. What if we could just dot, dot, dot?
Hope springs eternal, though,
it does.
Doesn't it?
And you
people
want, you
know, always try.
And it makes sense. It makes sense to try if you could do it. If either it was possible, Max, I'd do it. I would suspect that. And by the way, if you'd missed that crash in 2020, when we had the fastest bear market and the fastest recovery in history, so the shares were at their lowest on March 27. I've got these numbers here. There's a weekly chart, so it might have been a couple of days either side. By June, they were up best part of 30%. So, you know, you had to be right. You had to pick the right time to buy in. You had to pick the right time to do it all. If you'd missed that and said, I'll wait a bit, you missed that whole opportunity. And by the way, since then, shares are up another, I don't know, 20, 30, 40%. So
it's worse than that. It's worse than that because let's say you do it. And there are characters out there like Dr. Doom, Nouriel Roubini. Yeah. There's people out there who are very famous for calling it, actually, called the top, saw the crash coming. And I don't know how well they actually played that in the end. But the trouble with they all tend to be one-hit wonders.
Yes. Yes.
Like, well, you got the, I mean, it's like, you know, economists predict 9 out of the next 4 recessions thing. It's sort of, so it's not only do you have to call it right, not only do you have to be able to then have the fortitude to buy when everyone is selling. Yes. And remember, things are cheap. It's because there's a lot of uncertainty. It's not because people are dumb. It's like, it's so easy in hindsight to look at COVID. I remember when that was breaking news. Yes. It was like, it could have been like from the movie Outbreak. Like, we had no idea. I mean, it's laughable now. Like, you got a big smile on your face. But I mean, there was a week or two there, which was like, we were all like, even when we're getting our groceries delivered, we're wiping them down before we bring them into the house. You know, we're walking with a hazmat suit out. It was bonkers. But you, there's just no way that you could have predicted it. And even if you did somehow say predict it, then it's just sort of like the world could possibly end, but I'm going to calmly go in and just like back up the truck. Like no one ever does it. And then somehow you overcome that and you're the one in a billion people who does that. It's like, great. You made a little bit of excess money than you would have if you just long-term held anyway. And by the way, now you've got to do it again and again and again as a strategy. And the other point I would make too is, and this is what always like really just sort of melts my brain when I think of markets, is because they are self-referential. The only proof that you need that it's not possible is because no one does it.
Yeah, that's actually true itself.
And where it melts your brain is, it's like, well, hypothetically, let's say you could do it. Well, the very act of doing it would then be arbitraged away as people front run those that were going to prosecute that strategy. So no strategy works at any kind of scale because if we all agree that we're going to – it's like the Santa Claus rally. Markets always rally in December. It's complete rubbish, right? But it's for some one of these things that's just sort of stuck. But it's like the reason it doesn't work is because – as soon as people sort of noticed it, people started trying to front run it, which actually caused the price to go up sooner, which meant that it wasn't a Santa Claus rally anymore. Well, so it was a November rally.
As you know, the Santa Claus rally actually followed the January effect for exactly that reason. That's precisely why. And the journos and the guy commentators won't say to you, well, it used to be the January effect, now Santa Claus rally. They're just talking about the Santa Claus rally as if it's a thing in isolation that somehow is preordained that it must be a Santa Claus rally. It's like, no, that was literally caused by people front running the January effect, who now believe the Santa Claus rally is real. And as you say, it'll be the November effect, then it'll be the October effect, then it'll be the December effect, and then around and around and around we go.
And even where it is real, it has to be real to the extent where it's economic to even prosecute. You will see lots of all the time, in fact. A company gets a takeover offer. So it's trading at 80 cents a share. Someone lobs a $1 bid. The share price doesn't go to a dollar.
Yeah.
It goes to like 98 cents or 97 cents or something like that because, well, there's a chance it may not get through.
Sometimes
there's going to be look what happened with Appen recently,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Yes, in the paper this week.
And so it's natural to, like that, the market will find a level at which it prices that risk, whether it's right or wrong, but it'll price it in that very sort of organic way. And it's just, you what am I trying to say here? It's sort of like, when you layer all of those things we just said together on top of each other, the degree of difficulty is so insane. And again, even if you got all of that right, you might go from the kind of person who averages 10% compound over the next 30 years to someone who maybe gets a little extra kicker of 12% per annum.
Maybe.
And I'm not saying that, I mean, obviously we know that makes a big difference over time, but that's assuming you're successful at all of this kind of stuff, right? Just hodl, stay humble, buy shares.
Yep, absolutely. The other thing too, Max, just by the way, is when you think about the declines, you have to work out at what point you would buy. And the bigger the drop you want, the longer you have to wait for that drop. So it is almost, you know, I want to buy shares, Paul, 15%. Well, okay, that'll be once every X period of time. I don't delay 5 or 25% or 30%. You've got to know what point you're going to buy, how many years of saving you have to wait for that to happen, how much the market goes up in the meantime. You can mathematically try and work it out. You grab some data and try and, you know, reverse calculate it. But yeah, very, 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 very hard. Good question. Very, very, very hard to do.
Oh, that backtesting doesn't work either. Let me throw cold water on that. That was a big thing back in the day when, how old we are, when software for the markets was like sent you in a box through the mail.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a company, like several, that they offered backtesting. So you could come up with a set of indicators. And how would have this work if I had done this over this period? Yep. It was like so compelling as a sales proposition because you're like, I can find the combination of factors that will lead to alpha, to lead to outperformance. But of course, you see, you know, there's ghosts in the machine. There's phantoms in the data. And it just sort of, you see all these correlation causation. And it's just, it's not there. And if it was there, it would then get very quickly arbitraged away. So you've just got to be the first person to know, the first person to prosecute it, to do that successfully and make sure that no one else figures it out along the way. And like, oh, I just buy a passive index fund and go play.
Well, no, that, mate, that thing you think you see may actually not happen again anyway. Even if it is real, even if no one else sees it, you're the only person who sees it, doesn't mean it's going to repeat. The causal factors required, the complexity of the economic engine is such that you're just not going to see it coming. It's not going to work that way.
No.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Mate, one from Andrew, who... I like this. I like you saying nice things about us. Hi, gents. Thanks for your weekly podcasts. I've been enjoying listening to them for the last year or so and getting a lot out of them. Welcome to the team, Andrew. In particular, I find it interesting when your thoughts and discussions go much broader than just looking at specific stocks, etc., and venture into related discussions about interest rates, tax, population, and social policy, etc. That's right, we're the finance podcast that occasionally does finance stuff. I have a question that I've wondered about for a while related to Australia's compulsory superannuation system. We did talk a little bit about that on Friday, Andrew, so I'll try not to get back on that one. Doesn't this, he asks, artificially skew the supply and demand model in the share market? Every week, 11% of the country's wages bill drops into the market without anyone making an active decision. He says maybe 99% of people anyway, if we exclude SMSFs, who might be a little different. Andrew talks about the property market being a Ponzi scheme, but isn't this kind of the same thing? I'm not suggesting our compulsory super system is a bad thing at all. However, what are your thoughts about this artificial or legislated demand where money just flows into the market on a never-ending basis? Generally and over the long term, does this just keep propping up the system and prices? Does it mean that prices just continue to go up over the long term pretty much no matter what? Or am I missing something? Also, he says, this makes me realize why fund managers and the industry in general are so keen to get their little hands into super. Fingers in the pie of never-ending cash flows. Cheers, and thanks again for the great podcasts, Andrew. What can you tell me, Ray?
I mean, it's a tough one. Like, let me try. It's hard to argue that someone who's just sitting on the bid, who's completely passive, he doesn't care. I've not done valuation. It's in the index. I'm buying this much. There's new money. I've got to allocate it. I'm buying it. You know, all else being equal, it feels like, yeah, that'll drive the price up. But also, you know, price is set on the margin, right? And there's plenty of companies in the major indices that have fallen out of the major indices and gone bankrupt, you know, and new things come in. And so there are reallocations and stuff going on. And, I mean, if something got really ridiculous, there'd be some clever cookie out there that'd be shorting. And don't forget, like, price – demand always will find a supply, you know. It gets to a point where – existing holders of the asset, which was too good to be true. I kind of bought shares in CSL because I wanted to sort of have something in my super for the next 30 years, but you're going to offer me how much? You know, things kind of tend to sort of go that way. What I don't know is, can you say over a long stretch of time it's a zero impact? I used to say that, actually. I don't know if it is zero, but I don't know if it's meaningful. What do you think?
I tend to agree, but I will add some context. So a few things firstly, I suppose. Andrew, we know that superannuation is split between Australian shares, international shares, property and cash, generally speaking, in different forms. And so the 11% goes somewhere. A portion of it, probably the majority, but nowhere near the vast majority, goes into Australian shares. So the first thing you do is you discount that back by the money that goes into cash or property or international shares. In an absolute sense, think about balanced funds or even the so-called aggressive or high-risk funds or whatever they call them these days. You know, the vast bulk is still, the majority is probably Australian shares, but not by much. So you start there. Second thing I then add to that, and I get to Ram's point eventually, but second thing I add is if you look at the market isn't the market the same way the property market is the property market. The property market is every property in the country. So Australian property, when we say that, put a capital A, capital P on it, not Andrew Page, but Australian property, we get to, you know, the total value of every house, unit, apartment, you know, duplex, villa in the country. The value of the Australian share market is the sum total of about 1,500 odd companies out of the probably, 3 million small businesses or whatever the number is these days in Australia.
Big number.
And I say that, Andrew, because the money will go into that market, yes, but it's not a static or a closed system that is all the money, that those are the only companies that can ever have money bid on them. So while we say the market or the ASX and we do the index or the totals of the market capitalization, when Ram lists Strawman for $84 billion in 6 months' time.
Any day now.
That's a new company. So yes, there's new money going in, but there's also new businesses going in. And it's worth kind of keeping that in mind because this is a subset and it's a really amorphous subset of Australian business. The same, by the way, overseas with international businesses, same thing. So you're not necessarily putting the extra super money into the same 200 companies that we had 25, 50, 100 years ago. There can be more businesses. It can be less, by the way, as well. But I guess I'm just making the point this is it's not a closed system, it's not a closed loop. And so that's...
You know what? Sorry, mate.
Okay.
Sorry, I thought it was a bit of a lag. The other thing that just occurred to me too is there's probably a demographic bulge argument in the sense that at one point in time, I'm putting money into super compulsorily.
Yep.
Did I say that right? But then people come out the other end and they retire and they start drawing it down.
Yeah.
Now I wonder as the boomers who are, you know, an outsized generation because of, you know, the war and the whole that whole thing, they will go from contributing to withdrawing. And I'm trying to do the maths in my head here, but I guess it depends on the extent. But if there's a lot of wealth that's there, and a lot of that will be drawn down in the next decade or two.
Yep.
And I wonder if you really wanted to take a broad view of it, is it more trying to measure the demographic bumps, like where when a new cohort, generational cohort's coming in, how big are they? How much are they saving?
Yeah.
What's the rate that they have to contribute at? All of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, it's a fascinating question. I do think it's not, it's still at the same time, I don't think it changes the MO for any investor who wants to be sort of a self-directed stock picking kind of investor, not just purely passive. And if you are purely passive, I guess it's a little bit of extra wind in your sails, if anything. And if you're not, it may mean, look, at the margin, it might mean that you don't want to be, you might not be realistic in expecting very low multiples when there's always a bid on a lot of these stocks, maybe. But even then, I can't see it being radically different to what it would otherwise sort of be. So great question, but I don't think there's a practical so what to it.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I wouldn't, by the way, rely on super to say, well, I can't lose money in shares because we've seen the volatility of the market over the last few years. I guess my last thought on this one is if you look at long-term historical multiples, we're not miles away from that, particularly in the Australian market. The US market's very different and frankly probably deserves to be because of the types of companies. But if there was this wall of money that was somehow pushing up price earnings ratios higher than they deserved to be, you kind of see that. And there's no evidence that we are structurally higher in any meaningful way than we used to be. It's yeah, it's a theoretically great question. Practically, to Ram's point, there's no evidence, I don't think, of it being meaningful. It kind of should be, to your point, Ram. I think, by the way, I would seriously encourage people to invest overseas as well, because, you know, at some point in your own super or elsewhere, it makes sense given that potential issue and the quality and diversification opportunities. But yeah, there's no evidence. I don't think there's been a change to that degree.
Mm.
Mate, yeah. Tom, go on.
No, interesting question.
Great question. And a female question. Thank you, Jenny, for throwing your question into the mix. Always love hearing from our female listeners. Hi, Scott and Andrew. Thanks for the pod. My question relates to how companies that are doing a capital raise determine the price for that capital raising. If the options are priced at what I perceive as a low price, is this an indication of what the board thinks the shares will be valued at come option exercise date, or is it used as a sweetener to get shareholders to participate in the current capital raising? Many thanks, Jenny. Go for it, mate.
Well, it sounds like there's two parts to that. There's raising money by selling shares, and then some share purchases or some capital raises have an options component to it. So yeah. let's just start with the share part of it and how they price it. It's actually the market that prices it, really. I mean, they can put out, you know, I could put out a capital raise amongst my investors and say, I'm going to raise money at $1 million a share. Yep. And no one's going to be interested in it. Right. If I say 1 cent a share, well, maybe we'll get a few bites. So the company is going to set the highest price it think it can get away with to raise the amount of money that it needs. So it usually starts with a dollar value in mind, like we need $10 million for whatever reason. Okay, the shares are currently at this. That means we need to sell this many shares. Okay, well, we're going to be diluting people probably in the process here. So we need to make it a little bit sweeter. So we need to attract new money in. They'll often make it more attractive that way. And this is where the options come in. Sometimes you'll get a little bit of a kicker. It's like, oh, by the way, there's an options here that you can exercise if the price is above a certain amount. But the whole calculus is, what can we get away with? And it sounds Machiavellian. I don't mean it to. It's just like, it's like when you sell your house. What price can I get away with, right? Like, I get away with is a wrong term. But what price is enough to attract buyers of that? Because we've seen it before where some companies, I've actually seen it recently where some companies are trying to raise money at a price that was higher than the market price, you know, and completely didn't get away. Now, they announced the price before the share price dropped, and then lo and behold, no one took up the offer because why would you? I can buy it on market cheaper. So there is a skill and an art to it, but basically as much as the goal is to raise, well, let's be technical for a second. The goal is to reduce the cost of capital as much as possible. So you can either do it through debt, and we'll be familiar with interest rates, but there's a real cost of capital when it comes to issuing shares. It comes in the form of dilution. So it's just like there's a cost to that. And again, you can just like, let's take any random company on, let's take Woolies, right? Let's triple their share price. Let's say they want to raise $100 million. Mm. Well, if their share price was triple what it is now, they have to sell a lot less shares to raise that money than if it's at the current price.
Yep.
So you usually find, I actually think it's, a lot of investors get their knickers in a knot about this, but I think it's not silly for a company's North Star should be, what do we think the business is a fair and reasonable value for the business? They should have their own intrinsic value calculation in their head, a loose one, as best you can do. And whenever the market is excessively above that, I think you take advantage of that, you raise money. Mm. I think, provided, of course, you think you've got a good chance of doing something useful and productive with it. When it's well below that, that is the time for buybacks, right? Like that is the time. And I'm desperately trying to think of the company that's done this extraordinarily well. Is it Constellation Software?
Constellation Software, yeah.
Yeah, which, by the way, just Google that, Constellation Software, and read the story about that. It's one of the best capital allocators in the world.
Teledyne in the past is the other example. I think it was Henry Singleton, I think, from memory. Made $1 squillion from opportunistic share sales and buybacks.
And again, no one's being – it sounds like it's taking advantage, but it's not. The market is saying, we think you're worth that. And you go, okay, great. Well, here has some extra shares, and I'm going to take that money, and I'm going to – if I get – a higher return on investment than the cost of capital, and you know, is more than just a basis point or two in it. Job done. And even as a shareholder with the dilution, you were like, "Yep, please keep doing that, Mr. Magic Management Team." You know, that can just take my money and magically turn it into more money. So it's the more I've said this before in the pod, but the longer I've been doing this, the more I'm just convinced that capital allocation is the core skill of management for these big companies.
Yeah.
And you know, if that is your, that is essentially your job. I say set culture potentially and invest the capital. You're not there to run, you're not the chief operations officer, you're not the bean counter, you're not the CFO. Mm. You're setting the strategic the board I guess is setting the strategic direction, but you are always sort of looking through that lens of I have a finite amount of capital and I have a world of opportunity. What is the best risk return that I can do right by my shareholders and get the best return with the minimum amount of risk? And investors that, or managers that look through that lens and think long-term generally tend to create insane amounts of wealth for their shareholders. And they're rare. They're very rare.
I'm glad you did that last bit in, mate, because that's, we can define the right, perfect, best role for a management board. The reality is a lot of it's done terribly, terribly badly. And,
yep.
And it is one of the challenges of corporate life is when you have to pick someone to run your company, you, for your point about strategy and culture and capital management, none of those jobs are the jobs of the head of sales or head of marketing or head of HR or head of operations or head of IT or head of, you know, the Australian business unit. If you're a multinational, you don't have those jobs. It's a very, very hard thing to recruit for and train for, because you literally, probably the biggest change, any other part in the organizational hierarchy, you join as the assistant, the assistant marketing manager, and you eventually become the assistant marketing manager and the brand manager and the marketing manager and the marketing director and then the head of marketing and then the whatever. So you kind of build on that skill set. And then all of a sudden someone says, now your job is strategy and capital allocation and culture. Like, well, I hope I pick something up along the way, but I've not done this before. This is new to me. And it should be. And that's even the CFO. You know, yeah, probably know the numbers, but you know, these are new jobs and new skills. I'm going to be the cynical one for a sec, Ram, because the market determines the price, Jenny, as Ram has said, and that's absolutely true. Because there's no point offering shares at too low a price, too high a price, except that we also know there are conflicted incentives. So a fund manager who might be a large shareholder in your business, if you kind of give them a sweet deal by maybe pricing options a little bit lower than they might have otherwise been priced, or your share issuance at a lower price, they're going to feel pretty good about you because they might want to flip those shares for a higher price later. So you can make your life easy rather than saying, I'm going to offer these shares at exactly the right price where supply and demand meet, where I can absolutely just get enough shares that I need to raise the money I need to raise. If you own the business outright, that's exactly what you do. If you were a professional CEO, professional board, or professional something else, and again, I don't mean to disparage people who are very good at this and do the right thing, but if you are not that person, if you are someone who's like, well, I could try and make it $1.87.5, but $1.80 is close enough, and they'll be able to flip it for $1.85, and they'll make some money, and I'll be happy, and I'll be popular, and it'll all be fine. Don't believe that doesn't happen. And again, think about who's advising the CEO. Well, look, you need to raise some cash. I'd really price $1.80 just to make sure. You think? Yeah, I really do. Oh, okay, you're the expert. Okay, I will. The expert might also be the person who owns the shares and who is going to benefit from getting a very cheap price on those shares they're purchasing. So that's absolutely possible, absolutely true. A couple of things quickly to add. If you're raising more capital, you're diluting current shareholders. That dilution actually has a value, particularly if you're raising money to pay, if you're not buying a business or buying another operation or growing, but using it to pay down debt, for example. If your shares are worth $10, selling for $10, and you're issuing 10% more shares, mathematically you're at $9 before you start. If you're not going to add value or add earnings, you're just diluting people further. So by definition, 10% more shares means a 10% lower share price. So the starting points matter. I've actually seen, I want to say it was Corporate Travel. It may not have been. I own shares, so I don't want to over-egg the pudding on this one if it was. I'm pretty sure they actually issued shares at a higher price or the same price as the current share price. Why? Because they were buying a business that was going to add value. It was earnings accretive.
Pro rata.
And so, right. So it was making more value by buying
Sorry,
it.
Sorry, pro forma.
Yeah. So the company said, well, hang on. If we're going to buy this business, but it's adding more value than we're actually outlaying, we're not going to discount this. We're going to add value. We're going to issue at the current price or the higher price. And the more the market likes what you're doing, the more they're going to pay for that because they see the value in doing that. So it's a really messy one, but Ram's 100% right. When it's done properly, it's just a case of how much can I get from the market for this thing that I want to raise money for. If it's a non-value accretive thing, you're going to have to put your hand in your pocket. The other thing, by the way, is there is, to be less cynical but also very real, there are some circumstances where you need the money. You know, we've seen significant allocations, significant problems where businesses have said, we're in the toilet here. You know, we're in some real trouble. You know, we really need to raise some money. That is cap in hand stuff. And that's where you go, if we don't raise – big companies do it too. We've got a bill to pay. We've just made a $1 billion acquisition. I need to make sure I collect $1 billion. If I can only collect $900 million, I can't make the deal. Mm-hmm. So they've put themselves over a barrel, which is stupid. It happens all the time where they say, I really need this money. So I can't afford to just fall short. I got to absolutely make sure of it. What does that mean? It means you're a forced seller. You are absolutely over a barrel. And so the buyers can effectively not quite name their price because there's competition out there. But you are desperate. So you're going to give them a sweetheart deal to make absolutely sure you raise exactly what you need and not a cent less because you can't do the deal otherwise. And so that's important.
Yep. You see, I mean, it's something to really pay attention to in the small cap space because many these companies are not profitable yet, are not cash flow positive. They're yep. They're in that sort of growth phase, and it's not a bad thing. I mean, it's a natural part of the life cycle. But you are reliant on the kindness of strangers. And we go through periods where strangers will just throw money at you, and you'll get to other periods where we're kind of been recently and maybe coming out the other side of it. But for a lot of people, they just can't get arrested, you know? And it's sort of like, and then to it becomes an question of, it's existential, yep. right?
Correct.
And,
exactly.
And you've got no negotiating yep. power. And then the company might survive, but you know, any existing shareholders mm-hmm. are diluted to everything. So.
Yep. Mate, let's move on to a great question. I really like this from Charlie. He says, Dear Scott and Ram, love the pod. Thank you, mate. Have been tuning in for the past few years and have benefited a great deal from taking steps to follow your advice. Thanks for all you do to improve the world of financial education. Thank you, mate. A question for you to consider. I love, says Charlie, the idea that the next wave of millionaires could be ordinary people who save sensibly, live within their means, invest wisely, he says broad-based, low-cost index funds for most of us, and let time and compounding do its work. Therefore, I am following as closely as I can to that strategy. My wife and I have maxed out our super contributions each year for the past few years. Well done. Split between low-cost US and Australian index funds. We're also investing in low-cost ETFs, mostly through a family trust. We aim to continue doing both for as long as we can. Given that folks who follow this kind of approach for a number of years could potentially achieve wealth in the millions of dollars in their lifetime, I have the following questions. Firstly, how much net worth would you be comfortable holding in ETFs before you would think about reducing your exposure and/or consider investing in other assets or other asset classes too? To put it another way, what risks and/or opportunity costs might one need to consider if they were to hit $1 million plus before retirement age? Let's assume this $1 million is divided across four ETFs, say Vanguard, Total US Market, NASDAQ, Australia, emerging markets, and a couple of solid listed investment companies, and super with a similar makeup of holdings. Is there a dollar amount past which you think someone might need to consider alternative places to invest other than ETFs? What might that number be and why? And where else might you invest? I'm genuinely interested to know how you would think through your options. Perhaps some planning now might improve outcomes later. Charlie says, general advice only, of course. Thank you, mate. Thank you. Keep up the great work and straw full on. That's from Charlie. Good question, mate. What's the calculus when you start to diversify away from broad, low-cost ETFs?
I'm going to come at this probably completely differently to the answer that most would give, which is I would say the more money I have, the more I would have in the ETF. And the reason being is that, well, think about it. Let's say I've got $10,000 saved. I'm young. There's probably cost obligations on the horizon. If I'm starting a family, maybe I want, you know, to put a roof over my head, these kinds of things. It's like I just can't allocate everything to something as volatile as the share market because I don't know what's going to happen. Now let's go the other end of the spectrum. Let's just be stupid. I've got $100 million and I put it all in ETF. Now, one of the great things about an ETF, especially with these big index ETFs, is they can absorb pretty much anything you can throw at them.
Yeah.
No, there's very few assets that you can do. You try allocating $100 million to fine art.
That's right.
Or, you know, or maybe you could just buy one Mona Lisa or something. But generally speaking, or wine or, you know, bricks of gold. Like it's that's one of the great feats of financial engineering. I don't even mean it in a negative way. I mean, ETFs are a wonderful sort of portal for people just to get you on instant, low-cost, broad-based exposure to the biggest capital markets in the world. Yeah. Click here. Yeah. How much have you got? I mean, look, unless you're Warren Buffett, they'll take whatever you can give it. Yeah. And when I've got $100 million.
And you get the money out the same way, by the way.
So when I've got a million, let's say the market drops in half. Now, let's say the first example, I've got $10,000, I've got nothing in the bank account for any emergency. It gets cut in half and then an emergency happens. The fridge goes on the fritz and I have to buy a new one. It's like, it's gone. I'm selling at the bottom. I've got $100 million and it drops by 50%. I was like, it sucks. It's not a good day. But, but you know, presumably, unless you think the world is over, that the markets will eventually come back. And I've still got all the money in the world for caviar and private yachts. Like it's in inverse to what you would think.
Yeah.
And because it is so liquid, because it is by design so diversified, I don't think you have to worry about it. So I'm coming at it the completely opposite way. The more you have, the more I would put in there. Why have an ING account, high interest saver, when I've got $100 million? Now I'm just pulling that number out of thin air, whatever number is it. Maybe it's $2 million, $3 million, but there is so much money there to meet any short-term kind of unexpected need.
Yeah.
And the rest, I want to just work as hard as possible. And I think too often in avoiding volatility or by being clever, all we do is shoot ourselves in the foot. Lean into it. It's part, the reason why the share market is the best performing asset class is because it's so volatile. You take one away, you take the other away, right? It's you get the returns there if you deserve the returns because you've got the, you know, you're being sensible with it, knowing that this is part of it, knowing that I invest despite the volatility, despite things are going down. I'm investing when things are going up massively. I'm buying a share in the future prosperity of the society and the human race. Like it's just, that is what I am going to do. And it's just, for me, it just doesn't make any sense to sort of say, nah, I'll take cash, which I know is going to like bleed me at like the rate of inflation. Let's call it 5% to be generous, you know, for forever, and be charged, you know, and just get a pittance worth in interest. But it's not volatile. It's like, no, cash is useful for short term, and it's the only thing it's useful for. And other than that, where else are you going to get the liquidity? Where else are you going to get the returns? Where else are you going to get the diversification? I mean, if you've got a thing for art, or you love property, or knock yourself out. But understand that 9 times out of 10, that alternative probably has a worse long-term risk-reward proposition than equity markets. I mean, let's not make definitive statements, but historically, that has been true forever.
Okay, but let me kind of play devil's advocate, mate, here, because I think what Charlie's getting at is people, when they tend to accumulate wealth, go from wealth accumulation to then wealth preservation.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right about working your money as hard as you can. But at some point you get to the point where it's like, okay, I've got enough money now. I no longer really want to have my entire worldly wealth tied up with the share market just in case.
Yeah.
I might go on to buy some property. I might go on buy some bonds. I might go on, I don't know, find an alternative asset class, gold or Bitcoin or something else. Not sure I revoke you, by the way. but you know, I went, you know, and family offices for high net worth individuals do this all the time. You know, I've got my $10 million. I've got my $20 million. I've got enough. Yeah. I don't really want to maximize my returns anymore. So your point is right for someone in accumulation phase who is all about maximizing returns. But, you know, shares, maybe they are risky. As you say, maybe I'd like to have a farm or, you know, a block of units, or I'd like to have some gold or art or bonds, because at least I know they're non-correlated. I know the money's going to be there if I want it. And so they kind of – now you can reject the premise altogether and say, I wouldn't do that. I would just continue to accumulate, which is perfectly fine. I just feel like Charlie's question is, if I have a runway that says, I think at retirement I will have X – multiple millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. What asset should I be buying now so that when I get there, I don't have to reconstitute my portfolio, but I have that kind of preservation angle built into what I'm doing, not just pure accumulation, maximizing returns?
Well, when you get there, you can certainly make that choice. But, you know, that's why also no one will remember your name. You know, to quote the great Brad Pitt meme, you know, it's the idea of There's no wrong answers here. They're just, you've got to understand in life and in investing and in everything, there's compromise. It's like, you want stability? Great. You're going to get lower returns.
Yes.
Is that wrong?
No. I think Charlie's saying that. Where should he, at what point should he consider taking the lower returns for the purposes of preservation rather than accumulation?
Oh, well, whenever that point is that you think, when you've gone from, if you get to the point of I've got enough, then that's probably the point to start going into more stable kinds of things. You'll regret it. I would very much. I mean, the reason the billionaires of this world are the billionaires of this world is because they didn't tap out when they made their first 20 million, right?
Yeah, true.
Like, and I'm like I'm being a little bit tongue in cheek. I'm not saying we all have to try true. And be sort of Mark Zuckerberg.
That's the Murdoch versus the Packer thing. Murdoch bet the company two or three times. Packer said, I'll never bet the company. Now, Packer still, James Packer now, but this is, I'm talking about Kerry. The Packers are still extraordinarily rich. But there's a reason they're further down the rich list than they used to be. And Rupert's running, you know, a couple of very, very large, well, not running directly anymore, a couple of very, very large media businesses in the US because he bet and bet again and bet again. You're exactly right. They are the two paths.
That's how you do it. And so I'm not here to say it's one way is right and one way is wrong. It's a personal question. But to answer your specific point, when you've gone, okay, maybe 10 million is enough. I don't know, whatever the number is. It's like, okay, well then no harm, no foul. Put some in cash. But there's a cost to that. And ask yourself too, the what if, you know, if we do have $10 million and the portfolio drops by 50%, I mean, the amount that we're spending in that in particular, maybe we pull back a little bit because we don't want to be sort of selling at that point in time. But does your lifestyle really change at that point? Yeah. It doesn't. So I might be a bit out of the box with that, but I think if you start thinking about that too early, let's say you get to $1 million and you're 50 and you say, yep, I'm done. I would put it to you that it's like, really? You could live for another 40 years, right? And
in fact, likely to live another 40 years. Not even
you're likely to live another 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, $1 million, I think it depends on your generation, but you know, this is inflation, right? When I was a kid, $1 million.
I know. A lot of jackpot of $1 million is, unimaginable wealth, right?
It's insanely a lot. I mean, but now it's sort of like, what are you talking about? Like, the median house in Sydney is $1 million. It's sort of like, it, and I suspect that only continues to be a thing. So it's sort of like, you're now in the year 2042 with your $1 million and it buys you a Tesla. Right? Like, it's like, it ain't the money you might have thought it was. And you may have preserved that really well and avoided a bunch of volatility for the last decade or so, but maybe you needed to lean in a bit to that as well. So just put whatever is aside comfortable, that is comfortable for you. But I'm not saying bet the farm. But I'm not saying don't take all the chips off your table as soon as you hit some threshold, because it will cost you over time.
So Charlie asks the two questions, mate. What might that number be and why? But then where else might you invest?
Can you know what I'm going to say? You know it. And I say, I said it with a straight face.
You're not going to invest in Bitcoin for wealth preservation. Come on.
Oh, that's exactly why I would invest in Bitcoin. 100%. Yeah. I mean, again, has Amazon shares been a good store of value?
Yep.
Well, yeah. Was it volatile? Yeah. But there's no 4-year period.
You wouldn't have invested in Amazon in 2000 for wealth preservation, though, surely. That would have been in the high growth. You would have been diversifying away from Amazon at that point. If your goal was wealth preservation, to your point, you would have missed the upside. You're almost, my sense of your answer is, I just reject the premise of the question. I wouldn't try for preservation. Why would you bother? You can accumulate and keep accumulating. So why not do that?
Yeah,
I'm trying to engage with Charlie's question, which is kind of like he's saying, well, at some point, I would like to go from accumulation to preservation. How would I think about what that number would be for me? And if I was going to do that, what assets would I consider diversifying into for that purpose?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's personal. I mean, I'm just giving you my answer.
Yeah, for sure.
I would put a bunch in there. And I always come back to we say it with shares, right? The two most important questions. Is it around in 10 years?
Yeah.
Because if that answer is not true, then I'm not investing. Yeah. And is it worth materially more than it is today? As long as those two things remain true.
Yeah.
And then I'm in, right? And I'm such a maxi at this point, mate. I'm at the point where it's just like, I think it's one of the very, very few things that you can be certain will be around in 15, 20, 30 years time. So it's sort of, you have to kind of make your own journey to that point. And most people aren't there yet. And maybe I'm wrong, but that's why I would choose what I would choose.
Yeah, fair. Charlie, I'm probably still pretty close to Ram's answer. I mean, I'm mindful that, you know, Bill Gates is one of the largest private farmland holders in the US. And so for a bloke who, you know, has built his fortune on technology and investing in the stock market and all that kind of stuff, he's choosing farmland. I get that. And it's very, very common. A lot of high net wealth individuals, family offices are diversifying for exactly that purpose, is, you know, not losing it becomes more important than growing it to its maximum level. And so I get the question. I think you're right. For all of that being said, my sense is that, so here's the thing. If you're desperately keen to avoid losing what you have, and you get to that point, I get why farmland or just land in general is something that people invest in. When your job is not, I want more of this, but I want to make sure it's there. Because if there's a 0.5% chance that the stock market crashes meaningfully and permanently, 0.5% is still one every 200 years. Now, it hasn't happened in the last 200 years. So now, you know, you kind of say, well, hang on, it's the old earthquake thing, right? It's every 6 million years, but we've been 6.5 million years since the last one. What price do you put on those, on the odds? And so I get that people are like, well, the land is the land is the land. It could burn, it could whatever, but I can reseed it, I can regrow it. It's there, it can't, you know, it can be taken away by force, I suppose. But I get why people would look at that and say, well, at least if I've got it, I've got it, right? I don't have to worry about what people think Woolworths is worth. If Woolies does get somehow destroyed by Amazon or Kogan or something, I'm going both of those, I should choose something else, Costco, then at least I haven't, you know, the land will be there and it'll be worth something and I can use it or I can rent to someone else to use or I can sell it to someone else for their use. It's a physical asset. I get why people would, and same with gold. Gold is gold is gold. It's a physical thing. It's there. I can see it. It's in the safe. Do I want everything in gold? No, but maybe the safe gets broken, but Woolies survives. Maybe Woolies goes broke, but the gold is there. Maybe they both go, but I've got some farmland. I get why people who are trying to preserve large fortunes would absolutely look at diversifying that way. That being said, I don't know how big my portfolio would need to be to start making those decisions. I could imagine this is not going to be me, but you know, in a parallel universe, if I was a squillionaire, I would absolutely have a farm because I just kind of like farms. It's just my, you know, I'm getting old, and I like the idea of a, you know, I would love a 100-acre bush block of land somewhere, you know, an hour away here, where I could just go to and be not as a prepper, just because it's cool. I'd like to have a campfire and a little hut and whatever, you know. So would I do that with some of my portfolio? Yeah, probably. Would I do it for asset preservation? Not really. I guess I might feel good that it's there if I wanted it for that purpose. I guess, you know, it is diversification to some degree, but I don't know. I don't know at what point I would do that.
I mean, you're diversifying away from what's already diversified. It's not that companies in the index aren't going to go bankrupt and be terrible investments. You're betting on the continuing longevity of the US equity or the Australian equity market. That's what it is. And whatever companies happen to be the top 20, you'll get them by design, by guarantee. I mean, it's
possible if you're in Cuba in 1940, you made the same bet. And then the government nationalizes everything and you're back to whatever's left. So, you know, there are circumstances in which just to Charlie's point, I want to kind of at least entertain the idea that there are circumstances in which capitalism is overthrown or whatever else. You think, but I had $10 million of shares in this ETF and now that's gone and now I don't have anything and I wish I'd bought some land or I wish I'd had some gold bars or I wish I had some sort of digital currency that was, you know, not able to be tracked and truly multinational and I can't imagine what that would be and I'm sure you don't either, Andrew, so I'll move on.
No idea.
But that, you know, that's why some people own Bitcoin, right, for exactly that purpose. It's
a lot of people.
There is, right, and so there's, I absolutely hear it, Charlie. And this is the thing, right? It's some future in 45 years, someone plays this episode after Australia's become completely communist and, you know, we're all working, I'm not going to be able to, everyone's working on plots and you know, giving all their produce to the government to distribute or something. And you go, man, I wish I'd done X or Y. Because it's possible. It's absolutely possible. And if your job is absolute preservation, at one point you're mad not to say, well, the chances aren't very high, but it's not going to cost me much. I've already got $100 million. Why would I not have 10 million of that property just in case? I'm like, well, I completely get it. For me personally, given my meager needs,
yeah, but if that happens, the state's taking your land.
Probably,
right?
Exactly. You know what I mean? There are outcomes where maybe shares are never valued that highly, and you know, you were to make that argument about property, Ram, and property has been in the past meaningfully multiples less as a proportion of household income, for example, this could be a permanent increase, or it could be a bubble that goes back to three times income, in which case people lose 75% of their assets. Like, well, shouldn't property owners have had something in shares just in case that happened? Yeah, I think they should. I don't know. We're extending the answer. I don't mean to do it other than – not trying to make an argument, just for the sake of entertaining the premise of the question, Charlie. For me, what number would that be? $10 million. I pick a number, right? Below that, I'd rather be in a diversified portfolio of Australian and international businesses. I think that would make sense. More than that, I mean, you get an average of 5% yield from the ASX. If you've got $10 million, you're getting $500,000 a year in dividends. At some point, you can afford to say, that's probably enough. I'm okay. I can go and do something else with the money.
And by the way, dividends aren't nearly as volatile as share prices as well. There's some great charts that are out there that you'll find, which is just sort of, even when crippling bear markets, a lot of companies get have their dividends cut, but they maintain it. And so it's sort of like you find that sort of like, the income I was receiving's dropped, 25%.
Yeah.
And then 2 years later, it's back to where it was. And then we're
off. Totally. That was a GFC experience.
There's no volatility. There's no volatility. Be careful with my words. There's far less volatility when it comes to dividends. So, and again, when you're getting $500,000 a year in fully franked dividends, it's like, I only got $350,000 this year, and then I have to wait a year before it's, that's why I'm all in. The more money I have, it's more, it's like, what can go wrong at this point? Great problem to have. Class A problem.
So I think that's what I do. At $10 million, I might buy a $500,000 bush block, and I might.
But that's not financial, though, right? There's an emotional, and there's nothing wrong with that, because that's you, and for others, it's like, why?
But
would I do
that? The value in the land is always going to be there. I'm just making the point. At what point would I stop with the absolute accumulation and go to some sort of diversification? Maybe at that sort of level, and I'm not there. I'm probably not going to be there, so it's not it's not an issue. But I just, and maybe that number moves because you get 10 million, you think, well, if it was 100 million, I'd do it. At some point, it's a mindset more than a dollar amount, honestly, Charlie, which is Ram's initial point. Where else might I invest? I would be hard pressed to go past property again, not because I love property, but the physical. If you want to diversify for preservation circumstances, you want something physical. So let me take a step back. If I'm not going to own shares, I'm going to take some of my portfolio and some sort of preservation strategy, what would I move to? I'd move to something physical. This is not a go at Bitcoin at all, Ram, but if I was going to, if I believed that I'm relying on someone else valuing my asset at a thing, and that was my issue, whether it's shares or Bitcoin or whatever else it was. I know they're different. I'm not trying to say they're the same thing, Ram. I'm not trying to provoke you. But, if I was going to say, I'm reliant on someone believing this is worth a thing. If it's not going to be worth a thing, it's going to be worth less than the thing. So I need something that I can touch and feel and know is there.
But just to push back on that, you buy a bunch of land because you think, I can touch it, so it's different.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean it can't drop down at 80% in value.
Of course. But I mean, it's usable and it's a physical thing that, yeah, you're right. It still relies on someone else having it.
Someone's still got to pay for it. Yeah. I mean, you can still, this is the thing. When you really start thinking through this, it's sort of like, what really is safe? 100%, actually not much. I mean, the safest portfolio is to have a go pack in the garage with a shotgun in it and a bunch of baked beans and some matches, because that's the, when we enter the Thunderdome of Mad Max, it's kind of like, that's the only portfolio that matters, right?
That's right. Exactly.
So if you're someone who kind of goes, but that's never going to happen, and I'm with you, it's like, if it does, it's like, I'll cross that bridge when it comes to it. But my operating procedure is to assume that it doesn't. And I think once you get to that level, it's sort of, that's what the gold bugs do, I think. Too often they sort of make this view on, but I can touch it and it's got 10,000 years of history and this and that. And it's like, and the world's a dark place. And, that's true. But when the zombies are coming and you come up to my house and I've got a shotgun and you've got a bar of gold, there's nothing I'm going to do to sell you that shotgun, right? Like you can have,
I'm probably going to shoot you and take the gold.
I'm just going to shoot you and take the gold anyway, right? But even then, I can't eat it. I can touch it. Thank you. Thank you for that. I can polish my rocks, but I can't do anything else with them. So that's the problem, I think, when you start debating this with some people and they go down that very dark route, it's just sort of like, well, nothing's good and bonds aren't. I'm not investing in bonds. I'm not investing in property that will be seized. I'm certainly not investing in shares. You know, it's like there's very few things that'll actually, correct. So, So, yeah. And generally speaking, hyper-pessimism on the human condition has just been the worst investment strategy you Correct. Could ever do. So,
and that, well, if you get to that point, you're prepping.
Yeah.
Which again is, well,
the preppers may have their day, by the way.
Right, exactly.
Like, you know, maybe, and then they'll be laughing, but, you know, it's kind of like.
That's literally almost the only alternative. If you're not going to own shares, be a prepper. Because the yeah. in between is, as you say,
yes.
gold or land yes. or whatever. It's like there's not much room. If shares go to zero, there's not a lot of chance that gold and land are the assets that save you, because whatever caused it to go to zero is probably going to take those with them. So you might as well invest in shares or be a prepper, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's like watching the meteor come in from the sky and go, whoop, I'm just going to sell my index EDF and buy a gold ETF.
Phew. Right. Yeah, exactly. Ooh, exactly.
Glad I saw that first. You know, I was like, well, I got news for you. Like, you're in trouble either way. So,
hey, Ram. Anyway, it's Easter egg time. For our loyal listeners that have stayed this far, we have a pretty exciting announcement. We are taking Motley Fool Money on the road. We are doing Motley Fool Money live. I'm a bit excited. I'm speaking a bit loudly. I don't mean to do that, but I'm just excited about it. I don't really have a good announcer's voice. All I do is go up in volume because that's what I do. But we are doing Motley Fool Money live on Wednesday, the 27th of March. If you're listening to this in 2 weeks' time, you've missed it. If you're not, on Wednesday, the 27th of March, if you are on the Gold Coast in Queensland, Australia, no other Gold Coast around the world, if you are in Gold Coast, if you are at the Mendoc Beer Brewing Company at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, the 27th of March, you can watch us do Motley Fool Money live. We're going to record two episodes, a regular Friday episode and a mailbag, which, by the way, if you're there, you get a chance to have your question answered live and then on the podcast at the Mendoc Beer Brewing Company. Now, you do have to RSVP. You can't just rock up. We do need to strictly control number. No, I'm kidding. You do need to RSVP. So go to fool.com.au/podcasts. Pretty straightforward, podcast with an S, fool.com.au/podcasts. Hit the RSVP link. You can find all the details and reserve your spot for Motley Fool Money Live. We've been talking about doing this for ages. We've had some listeners who've asked us to do it. I'm pretty excited we're finally getting to do it, mate.
Yeah, I'm a little trepidatious. it's much easier sort of just in your little dingy office with the UGG Isn't boots it? On behind the screen. You know, I was like,
can you promise us UGG boots on the night?
If, you know, if it was a different time of year, I wouldn't Plus take much persuading. Yeah, maybe a pair of thongs and some shorts. So.
We are going to come. So come along it's on the Gold Coast. So if you're not on the Gold Coast, well, if you want to travel, feel free. I would strongly encourage you not to do that. There's better things to do with your time on a Wednesday than travel to the Gold Coast to watch us do a podcast. But if you, by the way, it's just before Easter too. So, hey, if you want to do an Easter on the Gold Coast, start it off on a Wednesday, on the Wednesday, the 27th of March. As I said, go to fool.com.au/podcast. Get all the details. Reserve your spot. Do us a favor. If you are going to reserve a spot, please come. Sometimes these events, that's free, by the way. These events, people tend to reserve their spot and then not turn up, so others can't attend. So if you are going to reserve a spot, please come along. Don't leave empty seats and have other people miss out on their chance to come along. And we'll be chatting before, during, and after. So come and say good day. Come and watch the podcast get recorded live. If you can't do anything worse, then that's cool. Stay home and do whatever you want to do. It'll be on the podcast machine anyway. But if you are pretty keen to see whether Andrew Page does actually exist and whether he does have a Bitcoin necklace with a big B sign, big gold one. I'd say Bitcoin one, but it's digital, so it's gold. The big Bitcoin necklace. Make sure you come along on Wednesday, the 27th of March, to watch Motley Fool Money recorded live. I cannot wait. It's going to be lots and lots of fun. We get to meet you. You get to meet us. We get to have a chat. I'm reliably informed you may be able to buy yourself a beer while you're there too. So a decent chance that I'll have a beer while we're having a chat around.
This is such a recipe for disaster.
What could possibly go wrong?
This is a bad idea.
The worst part is we're doing two episodes, mate. By the end of the second episode, I don't know how many beers deep we'll be. We may have to limit ourselves.
Yeah, well, I have my concerns, but I'm looking forward to it.
If you enjoy the podcast, or if you would like to see us crash live on stage, slow motion car crash, come along, fool.com.au/podcast. All right, I think that's probably it for us, mate. Thank you for spending some time with me. We have one more to record before then, though. So will I talk to you next Friday?
Absolutely, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Hopefully we'll make it to the Gold Coast. Until then, Fool on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services Licence 400691.